How you doing, everybody? My name is James, and I'm an alcoholic. You may want to look before you left. Grateful to be here, so was I. I'm finding it necessary to take a drink. Got the Alcoholics Anonymous, sick, shaken, confused, and very defeated. Things haven't changed that much for me. But I also got here feeling unwanted, unneeded, and very unnecessary. But thanks to the people around the table of Alcoholics Anonymous, strong and intimidating sponsorship, and this fellowship and everything, I haven't found necessary to take a drink. I'm being brought to you. And for that, I am truly grateful. You know, I don't know where this deal and everything going to end up, but I know, to remember some of my past and everything, I was raised and everything in a very strict environment. You know, as children and everything, we wasn't allowed to think we owned anything. You know, I remember Bob was talking last night and everything about his parents and everything beating on him. You know, and I don't recall being beat at that level, but I did receive chastisement, you know, at a very strict level. And not just by my parents, any adult that was in that neighborhood was given the freedom, you know, to chastise the children. And as a result and everything, we had to, at least I did, you know, I had to go in other neighborhoods and everything to raise hell, and that's what I did, you know, and that's just the way I was and am, you know, and I rejected that authority in my life and everything, and after a while, once I got to the ripe old age of 18, I joined the military. I went to the Navy, and once again, everything, things got kind of rough on me and everything, and I rejected that authority. And they didn't really kick me out and everything. They released me what they call convenience of the government. You know, and I don't know if that's good, bad, or indifferent and everything, but I got out and I didn't want to be there no way. I hear a lot of people and everything saying that alcohol is a drug of choice and everything, and that may be true for them. But unlike them and everything, I did not choose this thing to do to me and everything what it did to me. Matter of fact, I had my first drink and everything when I was 4 years old, but I didn't drink it for the thing, the magic that it performed for me. I drank it and everything because those adults and everything was talking about that crow doing a dance on that bottle, you know, tipping his hat and, you know, twirling that cane and everything, and I didn't see it. And so I stole the bottle, of course, and I drank it, and it didn't do that. I didn't see all that stuff, you know. I didn't realize I was drinking for DTs, you know, but I did. But I didn't get drunk in anything in my first drink. You know, 4 years later, I had my first drunk. You know, that was I was 8 years old. It was just before Christmas of 1957. And from that day, you know, my drinking got progressively worse. You know, as a matter of fact, that's the only thing I ever did in my entire life. The more I did, the worse I got at it. You know, drinking. And for me and everything, as I recall, my last current drunk started somewhere in the week of Christmas of 1986, and ended somewhere in the last week of February of 1987. And I don't remember my sobriety date, you know, but I do remember when I brought to you guys. You know, and, it's been a painful growing process for me. You know, and, I'm not going to try to sit up here and try to delude you into believing that there's been a lot of fun. Because it happened, you know, it was very painful. I brought to the tables and everything, and I looked around, and I didn't see anybody like me, you know. All I saw at that time was a room full of dried up, shriveled up, wrinkled up hunkies. That's all I saw. You know, that's all I saw, you know. And they was nothing like me. I didn't see any blacks around the tables of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I felt strange and different and weird, you know. And I knew I wasn't going to make it. I knew I was not going to make it, you know. And I'm sure and everything, the people that knew me knew I wasn't going to make it. You know, and I struggled with that. As a matter of fact, I was sober about 2.5 years and everything before a guy came from San Diego and he took me to Founders Day in Akron, Ohio. And he had told me before going there that there was enough blacks in AA to make a Tarzan movie. We got there, and I walked around on the campus of University of Akron. And I looked around, and I saw a whole sea of black faces, and the tears came, And I turned to Bob, and I told him, I said, you lying son of a bitch. You know. And he said, what you talking about? I said, you told me there was enough blacks in the A to make a Tarzan movie. And he said, well, look around, man. I said, man, there's enough blacks in the A to make 2 Tarzan movies. And so, luckily for me and everything, I didn't have to seek out, you know, black AA. You know. And luckily for me and everything, you know, I remember that when I held on to that simple difference, that one thing, it kept me in pain. It kept me in separation. It kept me feeling unique. You know, and I could not fit in because of that one little thing. And so I had to go through the process and everything of learning. And I remember at my first meeting, I want to go back a bit. And I know I skipped ahead and everything. I was looking for somebody and everything that's smooth and polished. Guess what, folks? You got the wrong person. You know, because I'm not young. You know, I remember my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything. People were sitting around talking about you got to admit you're alcoholic and everything. You got to accept your alcoholism and all this other good stuff. And after my first meeting, Jimmy Schumacher, you know, he taught me, he told me the first step is very simple. He said, can you admit that you have had a problem with drinking on an ongoing basis? And I said, yeah. He said, how successful have you been in drinking? I said, well. He said, well, how successful have you been in, you know, in all the schemes and plans and devices and everything that you come up with? How successful have you been in not drinking? I said, I haven't been. He said, well, that's powerless. You know. And that's true for me. You know. I cannot drink alcohol successfully. Don't mean I can't drink it. I cannot drink alcohol successfully. And me doing the best I know how, I cannot keep me sober. And then I went on to the second part of the first step. And he showed me how I had been a failure at personal living. I've been a failure at personal living in every department of my life. Been a failure. And it wasn't because of alcohol. See, alcohol just used as a tool and everything to keep me out of having to deal with life on life basis. You know, I didn't have to deal with it. You know, and so when I can understand that I've been a failure because I didn't have to deal with sustained reality, then I can get somewhere. Until I understood that, I couldn't get nowhere. And it was a strange and weird thing for me then, and sometimes even now, because I still want to believe in everything. I have some control. I can call the shots and everything, all this other good stuff, but I don't. And sometimes and everything, well, all the time, it gets me in trouble. I hear people and everything, like myself, having a problem and everything with coming to believe. I had come to believe in God, and I didn't. You know, I didn't come here looking for God. I didn't come here looking for no job. I didn't come here looking for no wife. I didn't come here looking for none of this stuff. I got here and everything, you know, looking to learn how not to drink today, so I could die with some degree of dignity. And whatever amount of dignity I may receive and everything is more than what I had before I got here, you know. And so I had to come to believe in those people, those around the table. You know, it's strange, you know, but it talks about that in my book. You know, that's fine. I want to talk about that and everything. You know, I think I got a misprint. I'm serious. I think my book's a misprint because my book and everything tells me that I have to come to believe in everything or learn everything from people who are demonstrating a degree of stability in life superior to mine. You know, and that's all it talks about. That's all it talks about and everything in my book. But I got to follow these people and stop insisting on having a hotline straight to God. And I had a real hard time with that, you know. You know, before I got here, I had this problem and everything that people didn't understand me, and I didn't like that. Then I got around here, and everybody understood me, and I didn't like that neither. You know? And it was very weird, you know. I remember Paul and everything used to talk about look before you lift, and I didn't understand that. You know, this deal and everything, I don't know. I guess I didn't get enough sleep, or I'm pissed off, or something. Feel confused. But my higher power, and I don't apologize and everything for calling God and everything the highest, the ultimate authority. I don't want to, you know, slip back and trying to dilute the power that God has in my life today. I believe in this thing that God loved me enough. He gave me two types of angels, a spiritual angel and an earthly angel. You guys are my earthly angels. It goes back to, guess what my sponsor told me and everything, and the people around the table of Alcoholics Anonymous first told me. They told me, say, you're drinking, that's your business. You're staying sober, that's ours. That's ours. They told me everything, when you decide you want what we have, and if willing to go to any length, any extremes to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And so I had to make two decisions. See, I had to make two decisions. But I had to be convinced first. See, I had to be convinced first that you guys were the power greater than myself. And you guys told me to do things now, and I didn't believe in everything that what you told me was gonna, you know, what you told me to do was gonna work. I didn't believe it. And sometimes I did to prove you wrong. And sometimes I did because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't get around it. I couldn't get over it, I couldn't get under it, you know, there was no way. And so I did it. And it worked. And after a while I became convinced, and that was necessary for me. It was very necessary for me to be convinced that I was just above the apes, but below the angels. See, I had to be convinced of that. And you did. You're very thorough in your job. But I needed people and everything who was not just armed with facts about themselves. I needed people and everything who was properly armed with facts about themselves. And those were the people, you know, Jimmy Schumacher, Father Daniel, my present sponsor, and a few people and everything I do believe in today. And I don't believe in all of you, you know. There's a lot of you and everything that steal some jive-ass hunkies to me, you know. There are some white folks and there are some people and everything that's people. I'm still a prejudiced I'm bad, you know, still selfish and self-centered. You know, I didn't come here to get good and good. I haven't said it on me yet. And that's just the way I am. I don't know if it's because I haven't been around long enough or what, you know. But I have been able to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understood Him. You see, I could start. My big book tells me I should start with my own conception of God. But when I get to the third step, I got to give it up. Because if I should have grown by that time to the level that I should be comfortable enough in myself, in this fellowship way of living, that I don't have to insist on going off my way of doing things or my intellectual understanding of everything, that that's it. There's power greater than myself. There are people out here that know things a hell of a lot more than I do. And so I have to understand that. And sometimes I, like Jack Sutherland say, I just remember that. You know, I do. I forget that. And after I do this for a while, you know, I had to do this thing that was very tough for me because there were things I had done in my life that I was not very proud of, you know. I had to put down on paper, you know, that moral inventory. Well, mine turned out to be immoral. You know, mine was very immoral. You know, I had a lot of class, you know, like I discovered I had a lot of class. It was all low grade, but I had a lot of class. You know, I had to put down all those desperado things that I had done. I had done maybe once or twice and got drunken over 1,000 times. I had to put that down on paper. And I had to look at it. And then they told me everything. I had to admit that to God, to myself, and to another human being, the exact nature of it. How I could take that which is good and pervert it, or add to or take away from, in thought, word, and deed. That's what they told me. That's what I discovered from that. You know, how I could work off my own personal prejudice, my own personal fears, take a good thing and screw it up. You know, I could take a perfectly good running company and in 3 short days run it straight into the ground. I could do that. Now, I know none of you guys like that, but I am. I am. I could take a perfectly good running thing and add to or take away from, and in 3 short days run it straight into the ground. I have that ability. See, those are the exact natures of my wrong. I'll just screw it all up. When I did that thing, you know, I put it on paper, and I went in the bathroom, I got on my knees, I read off to God, and I don't know if God was listening, you know, even to this day, but I was. And then when I stood up and everything, and I admitted to myself in the mirror, I wanted to change it a bit. Because I couldn't look myself in the mirror. and admit all this desperado stuff I had done. You know, the admission that I had stole souls and sold souls. I couldn't admit that. You know, I could not stand up there and look at myself in the mirror and tell me that this stuff and everything. Because I wanted to see me as a great guy. You know, just been a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings. That's the way I wanted to see me. You know, but that's not me. You know, that was not me. And I had to do that. And then the tough part, I had to admit it to another human being. And a funny thing happened to me, you know, when I was admitted to this guy, and I'm going back in a little while and everything to some things that happened. I had to admit it to this little wrinkled up little Mexican, you know, this stuff and everything that I had done. And we was in my place. Get this, we was in my place and everything. And I was reading all this stuff off to him, and then it dawned on me, my mind tricked me a bit, and I thought, Jesus, he gonna throw me out of my house. You know? I knew he, you know, it just didn't dawn on me, you know, because that fear of rejection, I suppose, you know. I want to think loud and everything. I was wondering why, you know, this room was so small and everything. I thought it was because I was the speaker and everything, and they knew about it, and loud just let me know and everything because of their insane behavior, they was asked to leave. I know. That's the way I wanted to look at it. But anyway, I got through that. And I'm not going to stand up here and tell you and everything. I felt like a big weight and everything was lifted off me because I didn't feel like that. I didn't. You know, and I'd be lying if I told you and everything, like, all this stuff and everything happened to me. It didn't. None of that stuff happened to me. I still felt nervous inside. You know, there was still a lot of stuff and everything I had to work on. You know, because see, at that time, I still hadn't had to totally surrender. See, unlike a lot of you guys and everything, y'all had to surrender and everything at the third step. I didn't. My surrender, you know, at the third step was just my judgment, you know, my way of doing things. But that wasn't the surrender that was necessary for me. The surrender that was necessary for me came, the complete surrender for me came in the sixth step. See, that's where I had to completely surrender. When I took a look at all that desperado stuff that I had done in thought, word, and deed, and realized that I did not want to be like that. I did not want to do any of that stuff ever again, then I was ready. I was entirely ready to have God remove. Wait a minute, hold it. That's the second time I have to go directly to God. All the rest of the time it's been direct. But that's just for me. You know, I had became entirely ready because I knew then that I didn't want to be like that no more. I did not want to be like that no more. And when I fell short, I had to get back down in a kneeling position and humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. You know, that's somebody who's reading the deal and everything, you know, like, no one among us is to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Well, that's true. I won't be able to do this thing perfectly. I won't be able to maintain perfect adherence, but I can maintain adherence. I can maintain adherence. See? And so now, after realizing this stuff, now I can't justify, you know, well, I've only been sober 7 years. That's a bunch of cockamamie. I can't do that no more. You know? Because now I know. See, I'm not stupid. I just look like this. See? But I do suffer from massive amounts of ignorance. I suffer from ignorance and everything because, see, I won't read that book. See? I want to add to or take away from it. I've discovered everything. If I add to or take away from it, that's one of my defects of character. I'm addicted to that stuff. You know? I reject the good. In a New York minute, I will. I'll embrace the negative. See, I'm not controversial if you agree with me. And if I can get enough people to think they agree with me, then it's okay for me to do it. See, I had to discover this stuff. See, and he told me, when people and everything, remember, I'll tell you about the old hunkies? Well, not even my hunkies now, because they taught me some good stuff. And I rejected that first. But I learned that when they were talking about read just the black parts, they meant just that. I don't have to interpret this stuff. It's right there. You know, it's right there. Why would I have to interpret simple stuff anyway? But anyway, Then I had to make this list of all the persons I had harmed. And I had to become willing to make amends to them all. I just had to make a list of all the persons I had harmed and become willing to make amends. That's all I had to do. And I thought and everything at first and everything was those people and everything before I got here. You know. And Lou told me, no. And Jimmy told me also. But Lou reaffirmed me, said, well, James, you probably screwed over some people since you've been around here. And I had. I had known the nastiness and everything, character assassinations and, you know, gossiping, criticizing, judging. I had harmed a few people. Not many, but a few. And so I had to put that in there. That's why I had screwed over people. No different forms of prejudice, those different forms of fear. See? A different forms and everything of thinking I can take this thing and make a big deal out of it. You know, all the different forms of stuff and everything in my life. You know, I had harmed other people. And I still have that ability today. And after that and everything, I had to make those direct amends. And the first time I tried that, I almost screwed it up. And I discovered everything, I needed help in that area. I had to go back to my sponsor. And he said, well, use these words, do this thing, and we'll see where it goes from there. It turned out real good for me, you know. Nobody called me up and everything, you know, and said, hey, James, you can have this construction welding job back. None of that ever happened. That stupid wife of mine, she still haven't called me up and everything. Oh, honey, you know, she hasn't gone there yet. You know, and, the judges and everything have never said, well, no, I'm sorry, James, and everything. You know, we threw you in jail and everything. We were wrong. They haven't done that yet. They haven't returned. I'm not bail money, none of this stuff, you know. But things are better for me, you know. Because, see, I had stolen money from my dad and some of my friends, and I had to replace that. Not the way I thought it should be done, but the way they thought it should be done. You know, I had stolen meat from my mother's freezer and sold it for wine. I stole a car. And that's one thing I hear people and everything talking about, their parents and everything, you know, saying, you know, don't you have enough, you know, can't you just stop going to those AA meetings and everything? And my answer is, steal their car. Steal fucking phone. I bet you then everything they'll stop saying to you and everything. I don't know. That's just me. I don't know. But that's all I've done, you know. Anyway. I don't like too much talking about, you know, all the desperado stuff, because I've had so much fun and everything in this program, you know. What it used to be like, you know, really don't play that much part for me. But I have to go back to it and everything. I'm going to go back to it and everything, but I like to talk about the good things that happened to me and everything in this fellowship, because it have been, you know, the most part pretty good. And if it hadn't been at least 51% good for me, I'd have been back out there a long time ago. You know, I'd have been gone, you know. Because I don't know why. I won't come up with some lie, though. Every day, every morning, sometime in the afternoon, and every evening, I have to go back and review my day. Before I've been selfish. And where I've lied and cheated and manipulated and stole and did all this desperate stuff that I'm good at. And I'll see where I've screwed up. I hate making amends. And so one of the tools I use is I stay away from you. I stop trying to tell you what you can do, how to do it, and all this other stuff. I've learned this thing to stop trying to make decisions for you. You know, control your life. You know, I used to go along with that deal and everything, telling people to stay out of relationships when they first came. I learned a lesson from that one, you know, and I had to make amends and everything in that 10-step, and I hated doing that. And I went to my sponsor, and he told me, he said, well, if you can't manage your own damn life, how the hell do you think you can manage anybody else's? A few things, I've thought some things that I might have said, but I thought a few things about, you know. But I've learned everything through my own mistakes. And I've learned through watching other people. You know, you guys and everything are great examples for me. You know, you're the mirrors to me, to my mistakes and my growth. You know, and I hope in everything I never learn or think I've learned enough in anything where I can stay away from you. I don't ever want to get there. Then a funny deal had happened to me and everything. I had to continually work. I had to talk about seeking through prayer and meditation, or seeking through prayer and study to improve my conscience. Maybe that means my awareness level, my conscious contact with God. There again, I got something about direct stuff right there. You know, and I know if I want to know what L. Ron Hubbard's rule is for me, I'll read the L. Ron Hubbard book. You know, if I want to know what Hank's rule is for me, I'll read Hank's book. But now it talks about I got to find out what God's rule is for me. So I suppose I'm not too smart of a guy, but I'm figuring this stuff out, huh? I suppose to find out what God's rule is for me. I finally got to read the God book. And so I did. And there's some stuff and everything I've learned even more. Where God didn't want me to, quit my job and throw this foreman off the roof and go on by my business. I got that message one time. That's a story in itself. I learned everything that this dude said. He got a controversy with me. He's not going to talk directly to me. And that made me feel kind of bad at first, but then I learned everything. That's good, for me. Because, like the guy said and everything, ain't nothing wrong with the transmitter. It's the receiver that screwed up. And that's true for me. And so I still have to go back to you guys. And that's another thing I'm kind of pissed off about and everything. I think I've passed the, I don't know if it's five-year deal or a 10-year deal or 15-year deal, where you get this book and everything, and the 11th step and everything. In my book, it tells me I'm still inexperienced in spiritual matters. And somewhere along the line, these other people and everything got this book and everything where they are experienced in spiritual matters. And I want to get a hold of that book, because I haven't got that one yet. I don't want to raise too much hell about it right now, though. But when I get out of here, I'm right in New York, and I'm going to get me one of those books. I learned a few things about me and everything, then I was called upon to go and help a guy and everything that was drunk. That was not something I had planned on. It did my head ahead of a spiritual awakening. I don't know, but I felt different. This guy, if I remember right, he told me and everything he didn't want no niggas and everything in his house. And I said, well, how about a sober nigga? Is a sober nigga okay? That was funny, y'all. Take yourself so serious. Wake up, No. I thought it was funny anyway. What I'm saying. the guy and everything, one of the things I use and everything, because he helped me so much when I did talk to him. I still use that as a tool and everything. I try to stay sober to keep the doors open for him so he can get back in. Because he taught me a whole lot when I first came around. And I don't want to close any doors, and I want to be there. Be a part of the welcoming committee or the greeting person or whatever it's called and everything, that deal. It's getting allowed back in when you get over this uniqueness. Now I want to take you back. To this my last thrust of rebelliousness before all this happy stuff and everything happened to me. They say it was 2 years prior to things that happened to me. I was standing out in the driveway of where I lived at that time, yelling and screaming at the top of my voice and everything because I was in so much pain. And I was talking to Satan, and I was challenging Satan himself. I challenged him, matter of fact, to manifest himself into a man so we can do battle. See, I was incredibly ignorant, because I knew somehow that God was not inflicting this pain upon me. And so I challenged Satan. Let's be valid. And this girl came in there saying 2 years later, as I recall, it was only a couple of days, but she said 2 years later, I walked in the bathroom, and for the first time in my life, I saw something that I knew I could not walk. I knew I could not walk into the eyes of death, and it scared the shit out of me. You know, almost literally, you know. And they tell me I let out a blood-curdling scream. You know, and, they told me, you think you need some help. And I said, well, what's the help? I laid on some of the best sofas in the world. I practiced just about all the different religions. You know, I read some deep books. No one can help me. You know, nobody can help me. And this girl and everything that I was living with at the time, she told me, so why don't you call Alcoholics Anonymous? Never heard of it, you know. And like Neil always say, that's the best kept secret in the black community. AA works. But I never heard of AA, you know. I'm serious, I never heard of this damn thing. You know? And so I told her, what's that? What is AA? And she said, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, how do you get in contact with it? She said, in the book. I said, what book? Phone book. Anonymous? You say, yeah. I think you can be anonymous in a damn phone book. You know? Stupid. Well. And so I got that information. I didn't look. You know? But this stupid girl, she did. And it was in there. And these two people came out and talked to me. You know, and one of them talked at length. And the other one, everything, I couldn't stand that man even from then. He just walked into the house and he just walked around. He just, and nobody even asked him. You know, he just walking around in my house and everything. All back in the bedroom, in the kitchen, living room, all this stuff and everything, you know. And this other guy, they, you know, sitting there talking to me about all this stuff and everything. I'm not really paying that much attention, you know, because I'm keeping my eye on this other guy, this Mexican, you know. And so, just before and everything, you know, get ready to leave, the Mexican, he turns to me and says, you got anything left in this house to drink? And I said, yeah. And so he reaches into his pocket and everything, he pulls out this little card and he writes his name, his number on it. And he didn't even have the common courtesy to hand it to me. He just sits it on the table. He said, call me when you're ready to get sober, and he left. And I sat there, this arrogant son of a bitch, who the hell do you think he is? Well, that's my sponsor today. Rotten man. Rotten man. Don't tell him I said that. The other guy, you know, he called me. He was calling me, you know, every day. Every day. And he was asking me everything, all this stuff. And I said, I know, I got other things to do. And then one day he called me, and he did a great job of manipulation. So I tell you right now, there is such thing as positive manipulation, because this guy manipulated the hell out of me. And I tell you, you know, I'm one of those that was super sharp and ultra hip. You know, I run games on just about every gang in Chicago. I run game on them. I know I'm good. You know, I run stick belly, the flu, I run them all. You know, I've done a little bit of grifting. But this guy ran a game on me I had never heard of before. He called me up one day. And he said, well, I called you before and everything. I know you're busy. I know you haven't taken no shower. And I know you got other stuff to do. No, I don't. I've had a shower. I got on some clean clothes. And I ain't got nothing to do. He said, great, I'll be there to pick you up. And so he came and picked me up. He took me to a meeting. But again, this King Alcoholic of mine kicked me a little bit. And I thought, well, he know I'm a drinker. So he got to have a bottle for me. So I'm reaching around and everything for this bottle because I knew he, you know, nice guy he is, he'd be considerate. But he took me to this meeting. And that was my very first meeting. That was March 1st, 1987. You know, and that's when this deal started. And I remember, I want to tell you about my first sponsor, Debbie. You know, she told me that, baby, you're not going to be able to make it one day at a time. Because everybody was talking that stuff. You know, it's one day at a time. And she said, you're not going to be able to make it one day at a time. And she told me, you have to break this thing down. Maybe every 2 minutes,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And I couldn't remember the that serenity prayer. And so I wrote it down in my hands. And I used to walk around my fist balled up. And I remember at my first meeting and everything, these little red bumps and everything was formed and looked like welts and everything on my body. I shook, you know. And they say, from the way I can best describe it and everything, the way I found it was like covering it. If any of you remember seeing the Adams family, they say I sound like covering it. And, you know, just a horrible case for me. I remember sitting, I was 30 days sober and didn't know it. Then I was 60 days sober and didn't know it. I was 90 days sober, didn't know it. I was almost 6 months sober, still seeing double. Still seeing two people standing in front of me. You know, and they didn't leave me alone. So grateful for that. So Jimmy Schumacher, God, Fuchs, and Father Daniel would leave me alone. They told me I needed a lesson in humility. Father Daniel told him, go home and get on your knees and ask God. He told me that it's going to be painful. Okay, I believe. So I went home and I got on my knees and I called up God. And I said, God, these people tell me I need a lesson, you know, and you don't even can give it to me. But they also say it's going to be painful, and I think I've heard enough. I think I've suffered enough. And I saw this thing that I call smiling eyes. No lips, no nose, no none of this stuff. Just a pair of eyes. You know, and those eyes told me that humility is nothing more than getting direction and doing what you're told. That's all humility is. Getting direction and following those directions. You know, that's all it was. Just don't get no simpler than that. That's why I felt better. After that, I got hooked up with this girl. You know, I was about not quite a year sober. Kelly had driver's license and I had money. And we needed each other. Kelly had kids up in Des Plaines and Mattoon and Decatur, Illinois. And my parents lived in Joliet. But again, she had driver's license, I didn't. I had money, she didn't. And so I was in a car, and she would drive it. And we did that for a few months. And one night, I had this weird thing happen to me. Kelly drove like she was already dead. You know, and one night on my way back from Joliet, that she had picked me up, we were about 5 miles north of the Kankakee County sign on 57, and I noticed Kelly wasn't talking. I noticed that the car wasn't going like a bat out of hell, you know, and it wasn't blurry. The thing was shooting by wasn't blurry, you know, and I could see it, you know, I could actually see stuff, you know, and I turned and I looked at Kelly, and she was like this zombie type, and it kind of scared me, and I said, slapped on the arm and everything, no response. And we went through this barricade deal and all this stuff and everything on 57 up in the Kankakee area. It was on construction. And this voice came to me. And it was on a cloudy night. And it lit up. It was on a Plymouth Horizon. If anybody had ever ridden in a Plymouth Horizon, you know this thing is not a quiet vehicle. You know, it's very bumpy. It's like a stagecoach, you know, but not this night. This thing rode like we're on a pocket of air. No noise. The sky just lit up. And the voice said, pay attention. Well, I paid attention. I was nervous, you know. And I looked around inside that car. You know, there was nobody else there. You know, but that his voice. You know. And so my eyes were drawn to the speed limit sign, which says 65. And then my eyes were drawn to the speedometer, 65. Kelly didn't drive like that. That thing could have said 120 or 125, you know. But they was the same. They was the same. The voice said, pay attention. Pay attention here. So I did. Notice, outside, lit up. No clouds. There was no moon out, no stars, nothing. But it was lit up. To this day, please don't ask me to explain that one. But it lit up. I had no driver's license in about another hour or so of me looking and being pointed out different things. It was time for me to drive. And I said, I don't have a driver's license. Doesn't matter, the voice said. Doesn't matter. And so then I couldn't figure out how to get this car to the side without having a wreck. You know? And so the thing came to me, put your foot over the thing. Pull her foot up off the gas pedal and put your foot on the brake. Put it in neutral, let the use over. So I did that. And I reached and pulled her across and everything. Anyway, I got it all set up and everything. Well, she was in the passenger seat, now I'm in the driver's seat. And just before I get on 74, she wakes up, and then all these cops and everything up here. My heart starts beating fast because I ain't got no driver's license. I ain't got a fishing license. You know, and I get nervous. And the voice said, be still, I'm with you. No hassle. Cops shoot by me, cops going this way, cops everywhere. Before, cops were nowhere. Until I get behind it, and so I figure I'm being tricked here. You know, but the voice says, be still, quiet, I'm with you. And then Kelly comes to and says, what happened? I said, I don't know. I don't know. A couple of weeks after that, I was laying on the floor at home, and I've talked to people about this one and everything, and nobody... Well, there was one person that thing said they had an experience similar to this. I ran on the floor, and this black mass cloud-like deal, you know, with two red dots inside, was upon me. It wasn't on me, it was upon me. And it pinned me down on the floor. Well, I couldn't move, I couldn't breathe, and it was like sucking the very life out of me. And I couldn't say with my mouth, oh, God, help me. This is why I understand the language of the heart. Because from my heart came, oh God help me. And almost as fast as it was upon me, it was gone. It was gone. So I've had these spiritual experiences, you know, in my way of thinking. In my way of thinking, I've had spiritual experiences. Because that's the only way I can explain it. That's just me personally. Got around this guy. A guy that I had not yet believed in. I got this call from my oldest son. He was born November 29th, 1971. I got a call from him in April. 1987. I have not seen him since that birthday. Needless to say, I was kind of nervous, you know, because I didn't know how to deal with that. I felt guilt that I was not there. I had not been there with him. I felt shame of myself because, again, I was reminded that the things I had been taught to be and the things I had become, it was different. It was a tremendous amount of difference between what I had been taught to be and what I had become. The only difference was this time, I used to get drunk about it. I used to get drunk about, you know, my mother teaching me that I should be a servant to that queen. I was taught that, to be a servant, you know, to that black female. And I used to beat them up, you know, slapping around, all this other good stuff. I should be a servant to my people, to all mankind, but I wasn't. But this time, you know, I didn't have to get drunk about it. And my son called me, and the only thing I knew to do was call that guy that I had come to believe in. That the Mexican I seen up. Yeah, him. I had to call him up. And he came over and talked to me. And he straightened out a few things in my head. I had a deal where I did not know how to straighten out area in my life, where I walked around very nervous because I knew I had some warrants out against me. And I knew if these people found out where I was, I was going to go back to the joint. I had escaped the joint once. I was standing in front of that judge one more time, and they had a dead body. They had eyewitnesses, they had a murder weapon, they had the individual that had done it. And for the first time in my life and everything, for a long time in my life, I did what my mother had told me to do. She told me to get on my knees and ask God to get me out of that. I was standing in front of the Will County court system, charged with murder once. I did what my mother told me to do and I got out of it. And I walked out of that courtroom with the idea that I had beat the system. I had beat it. Well, they didn't come to shoot me out or nothing like that, but I had beat the system. You know? And then, after I got sober for a while, I realized there's some warmth out on me. And I could not continue to live sober, peace of mind, peace of spirit, accepting me, knowing who I am, what I am, and where I come from. I could not go on living like this. But I did not know how to get in contact with these people and let them know who I am and where I am, without them coming, locking me up and sending me back to the joint. See, I did not want to go back to the joint. And so I had to write this letter, and I wrote just a rough draft of everything, and I gave it to my sponsor. And he polished it up a bit. He polished up a whole lot. and he put some stuff in there that was very scary. And I read that thing. And I started sweating, you know, my tongue swelled up, you know, and I didn't even have to talk. I was just crazy inside. Because this letter was in great, great detail. And I had to fold it up and stick it in an envelope and mail it. And for maybe a month and a half, seemed like an eternity, I had to wait for that return. I couldn't leave. I wanted to run. I wanted to run. That's why I don't believe that geographical change and everything. To me, I'm like Keith D. It was interstate flight to avoid prosecution in my life. You know, but I definitely wanted to run because I didn't know if I was going to be sent to the Fayetteville, Menard, Pontiac. It didn't matter. I didn't want to go back to join anyway. But anyway, I got this letter back. I saw it and everything on there from the Will County court system. And again, my palms got sweaty. So I started shaking inside violently. My tongue swelled up. And the only thing I knew what to do was to take it to my sponsor. And he opened it up. And he looked at the letter and he smiled. And I said to myself, I knew it's a cruel conduct. I didn't know he'd be this cruel. You know, he'd be so happy to see me get locked up again. And he handed me the letter. And I read the thing one more time. I had to cry. The letter said, "We never heard of you. We never heard of you. You don't exist in our books." And here's an individual Red Hill, police system, hostage. It's part of an organization. Red Hill, a town, hostage. They had shootout cops. And my philosophy and everything, one time a badge is just a target to me. And they hated me. And I hated them. So I did this stuff. Now they tell me, they never heard of me. Well, I first kind of got my ego. They never heard of a magnificent Monday, huh? Well, after a while, I realized the power of God working on me through you is far beyond anything I could ever imagine. Far beyond anything I could ever imagine. And that's where it's been for me. And I don't add to or take away from. Something like the story I read for this guy. He had been to this place several times. One day he went in there with his bull whip and he stopped throwing things around and everything, yelling, screaming at these people. And he told him, he said, look, you get out of here, you get out of here, and you get out of here. You don't belong here. You're supposed to be here for one reason and one reason only. And he said, well, what about this? And he said, it don't matter. It don't matter about all that other stuff. You should be here for one reason and one reason only. And that's in my father's name. And he said, we've been doing like this for years. And he said, okay, you've been wrong for years. That's all. That's all. You've been wrong for years. You've taken that which is good and preferred it. You stop it. Now, look at the people. Look at the people as a whole. A few of you and everything is prospering. But look at the people. They're suffering. You know, they've been jumping along from crisis to crisis and not making it. You know, we've tear this thing down. Now we build it. Well, they thought they couldn't get this guy to change his mind, to change his way of doing things. And so they went about everything to make him look bad. They knew they had to get rid of him, you know. And so they started trying to, you know, I'll get people to lie on him, and they gossip. And they even tried to get another group of people and everything to hang him. They said, hey, that's not our style. And they said, well, we get enough charges trumped up on him, we get him. And they did. Well, for 3 days anyway. That's some Bible story. Don't be embarrassed. I don't know how to... Well, I won't tell you anyway. Miles Moody tells this story about this black guy and this white guy. Moody, let's not tell the story and everything about these two bank robbers and everything that are back in the early years, early 90s, 1900s. They've been robbing banks and everything, been successful in everything, robbing banks for many years. And then they got caught. And the white guy started crying. I'm going to be home. He's like, dude, Tennessee, what's wrong with you, man? We've been doing this stuff and been successful and everything, and now everything, bitching and moaning, complaining, we're going to be home. And the white guy turned to the black guy and everything and said, well, it's easy for you to say that thing because, see, y'all are used to it. Oh, what do you want? See, mom didn't it. I tell one little racial joke and you get upset about it. Jeez, what's crazy. Alright, I got another one for you. I don't know. Bob was talking about the big book thumpers and everything, and he was talking about me. I am a big book thumper. But I'm a big book thumper for me. You know, and I'm still like Jesse James at his first train robbery. You know, he was kind of nervous and everything. He never done this before. He stood up there and everything, both his guns out and everything. He said, I'm going to rob all the women and kiss all the men. And this lady over here said, you mean to say you're going to rob all the men and kiss all the women? And this guy over there said, would you let this man rob this train? Well, I don't know, it wouldn't be that funny. You know, I have to look out for the ones and everything who are going to let me go on doing this thing as I somehow got it screwed up thinking it's okay for me to do it. Because, see, I've learned everything that pervert, not necessarily homosexual, a pervert is someone who asks to or take away from. And I cannot continue to allow that type in my life. I need someone who will stand up and tell me, say, hey, don't you mean? And I say, oh, hell yeah, that's the way it's supposed to be. So I need reprimand. I need someone to help me with my inventory. Now, I know you don't need that, but I do. I need someone to help me. You know, all that I am, all that I will hope to be, I got from you guys, March 1st, 1987. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Thank you.